Welcome to the Synapse Nips podcast, where we explore the power of health and healing. On this podcast, we will be talking with health experts, professionals, and leaders about hot topics in the world of health. Whether it's tools to help you flourish, successful stories to inspire, or tips to optimize your health, Synapse Nips is here to help you take the first steps towards living your best life.
Welcome to Synapse Nips. This is Dr. Troy with Dr. Josh and Marquis. Today we're here to talk about high blood pressure, and we're also going to do a rapid fire, a Facebook rapid fire, some questions we've been getting online, and so we'll answer some of those today as well.
Sweet.
Yes, so let's start with high blood pressure. We're actually seeing quite a bit of that right now, and so let's walk through a little bit of what our protocol is.
Yeah. It's amazing, just a comment, how many people don't know what their blood pressure is.
Yes.
And how many people come in and it's high. But we should mention, too, just the whole white coat syndrome thing. Let's touch on that quick.
Yeah, yeah.
Because high blood pressure, when you go to a doctor's office, isn't actually a very good way to determine if you've got high blood pressure.
Yeah.
Yeah, the best way is if it looks like you've got a family history or your doctor is concerned about it, buy a blood pressure cuff.
Yep.
An automated one. They're actually not that expensive. What, 20, 40 bucks, something like that? It's a peace of mind thing. If you know that every day when you get up or when you go to bed, your blood pressure's within normal when you're not stressed at a doctor's office, you're probably pretty good.
Yep, exactly. And we'll go through some of the things that can increase your blood pressure. And even it's just nice to have those assessments done in the beginning of the day when you first wake up versus midday when you're active, and then end of the day. So it's a good, just informative test that you can do at home.
General comment on that. A lot of people are, I think, afraid to know what their health is. Like, they don't want to know their genes, and they don't want to know their test results, and they don't want to know if they got high blood pressure.
Yeah.
Because they're scared, right? They think if they ignore those things, it's just going to magically go away. It doesn't work that way.
It doesn't, no. Because if I lived that way, I'd also get rid of my mirrors. Because when I look in the mirror and all of a sudden I see a little extra weight in the midsection, I'd have to avoid that. So if you're the type of person that doesn't want to get their blood pressure results, then get rid of your mirrors too, please.
Yeah, it's good to be proactive about knowing these things about yourself.
All right, so let's just start with, first of all, some of the different things that can cause an elevated blood pressure. You already touched on one. White coat syndrome is an example of a stress response. Mm-hmm. And so we know stress can increase blood pressure. What else can increase blood pressure?
Yeah, blood flow restrictions. And so this is a common thing. Atherosclerosis, that's a little bit different. But basically anything that's going to disrupt blood vessel health, whether it's buildup of junk in the arteries or a stiffening of the arteries is going to cause an increase in blood pressure. Atherosclerosis, the sclerosis is the kind of the hardening, thickening type of thing in the artery. It's like you want your arteries to be like a balloon. You want them to expand, and they expand and contract kind of like your heart does. They keep the pressure built up, and if it doesn't work, your heart has to beat really hard to keep the blood pressure high.
Yes, it's kind of like a garden hose that expands a little bit more than your current garden hose. So you don't want to expand too much, but we want to actually see some level of expansion there, some adaptability. So that flow is really important. So think about the things that can irritate that. If you have junk in the actual arteries or in that garden hose, then it kind of blocks it up, and that's hard on the heart, and then pressure can increase. If you have hardening or stiffening of the arteries, like you said, from calcium deposits or from cholesterol deposits or from the actual nerves firing to the blood vessels, that can also cause problems. So those are some of the big things that can definitely affect blood pressure. I'm going to talk about one more unique thing before we get into some of the strategies to help manage it. There's also a scenario where you want to take your blood pressure on your left arm and your right arm and just compare the two. Yeah. Here at Synapse, we do functional neurology, and so we want to look for anything that's different or not communicating properly And people have just one heart, correct? That's right?
I think so.
That's accurate? Right. So you would think the blood pressure would be the same on one side of the body as the other side, but it's not. Yeah. So do you want to touch base on why that might be?
Yeah. When we look at functional neurology, one of the basic things we look at is the balance between the function of the right versus left side of the brain. People have heard of right versus left brain, and that's a simplification, but we won't go into too much detail there. Really, though, if you do have an imbalance where one side is functioning higher or lower compared to the other, the output of that part of the brain is going to change the muscle tone, not only in physical, like skeletal muscles, you know, the muscles you think of, but also you have muscles around blood vessels. And so if you have tighter muscles in the blood vessels on one side of the body versus the other, the pressure is going to be higher.
Yeah.
And that can be a consequence of a variety of types of neurological inflammation, trauma, like concussion, things like that. There's so many reasons for why that can happen. It's actually pretty typical for somebody to have an imbalance that way.
And generally speaking, if you're within 4 to 6, even 10 points, that's not bad. 10 points and above, those starts to get to a little bit of an imbalance. But I've had patients come in with a 20-point difference where it's like 150 over 100 on the right and it's 120 over 80 on the left.
Yeah.
And so depending on which arm was actually tested would potentially indicate whether or not they got a prescription or not from their medical doctor when it really wasn't a cholesterol problem. It was a nerve problem.
Yeah, exactly.
So it fixed the nervous system.
Way different.
The treatment is very different. Yeah. So that's just important. So if you're doing any at-home testing, also take a look at what it is when you are comparing left arm to right arm. Just a little trick. And then just know that it will be different standing versus sitting versus lying down. I always recommend if you're taking your blood pressure, if you just ran into the store at CVS Pharmacy or Target or something that has a blood pressure cuff, give yourself a couple minutes if you're sitting and just relax a little bit. Your blood pressure will go up with increased activity.
It's supposed to.
It's supposed to. Yeah. You want that.
Yeah.
So very, very important to just relax a little bit before you get that blood pressure. Sit down for 2 minutes and then take it.
And often, too, especially for people with higher blood pressure, it's important to take several readings if you've got the monitor at home. I have some patients where they'll sit down, rest, like you said, 5 minutes of sitting. But they'll take 3 readings over the course of maybe a few minutes because they're not always the same. The first one might be 10 points higher than the second. Taking an average of those is, I think, important.
All right. So let's go through our flow as far as what we look at. We actually have a flow sheet as far as someone comes in with high blood pressure, and we look at a bunch of different things. So we're going to start with some of the lab testing because there is a difference in lab tests as far as what we would order to get a little bit more clarity. Also, this we're not going to talk about today, but we do a test here at Synapse called the EndoPath that measures your arterial stiffness, your endothelial dysfunction, as well as your stress response.
That's a great test.
That's a great test for us to figure out if we're getting to the root cause of what's causing blood pressure, but even cardiovascular problems.
Yeah, we'll do another podcast later on that.
Yeah, we'll do. We've talked about in the past a little bit, past podcast, but it's a great test that we do in-house here.
Yeah.
So what's some of the other lab tests, though, that can be run? And then let's touch base on a little bit of the difference between just our lab tests and some of the standard lab tests that are out there.
Yeah, if you go to a medical doctor, they're going to only test your blood pressure and your cholesterol, maybe. They would correlate those blood sugar. They wouldn't look at anything too advanced beyond that because their only concern is if it's high, they're going to give you a type of medication to bring it down.
Yes.
And we won't go into the types right now, but that's not really fixing the problem. The lab tests that we look at are going to be anywhere from looking at inflammation. That's a big thing. Looking at inflammatory factors, looking at stress, looking even at some genetic issues. And so I think the scope of which what we're looking at is looking for the root cause of that blood pressure problem because you don't want to just cover up this issue.
Yeah, and when we're talking about cholesterol, they do total cholesterol, which can be good. It can give you some indications. They do LDL, the bad cholesterol, the HDL, the good cholesterol. Mm-hmm. But in the lab testing, a lot of people don't realize that cholesterol comes in different sizes. And the small, dense cholesterol particles can be way more catastrophic to a person than some of the larger particles because they literally get into spaces and nooks and crannies that can cause more problems. So the type of cholesterol you have really matters. Yeah. So I have so many people that come in and they say, my doctor wants me to put me on medication because my cholesterol is high. What is it? It's 220. I'm like, well, that is above the range, but what's your ratio to good cholesterol to bad cholesterol? Well, it's 2.8. Well, that's a great ratio. So if they have high cholesterol because they've been consuming a lot of olive oil and following a Mediterranean diet, we're not concerned about that. The Greeks and the Italians have the highest cholesterol on average in the world and the lowest incidence of heart disease. Yeah. And it's because the ratios are there.
Yeah. Cholesterol is really not a good indicator of cardiovascular.
It's not.
You know, there are some things with advanced testing that you can be more specific on risk, but a lot of it is more inflammatory. If your inflammatory markers are off, that's the killer right there.
Yeah, I'm going to give a shout out to a medical doctor that I followed years ago. This is maybe 20 years ago. I'm going to get the date wrong. But Dr. Ladd McNamara wrote a book called The Cholesterol Conspiracy Theory. And that was talking about the misinterpretation of cholesterol and how its impact on heart disease. He was way ahead of his time, and he felt like vitamin E and some of these other antioxidants were much, much better indicators to cardiovascular dysfunction. Mm-hmm. And now we have a lot more, a lot of other tests. So the lab tests that we're talking about here as far as the cholesterol, we'll look for those different particle sizes. We'll look at lipoproteins. There's also a genetic test that can be helpful, and there's a huge link with this particular gene sequence that also is got some impact when it comes to memory and Alzheimer's. Mm-hmm. So that's the APOE gene and genotype. So a lot of people can, you generally know if you've got genetics in your history when it comes to cardiovascular disease, because it's the number one or number two cause of death in the United States for a reason.
Yeah.
And so it's usually, it's number one, I believe, right now, but cancer sometimes gets ahead of it. But people tend to know if they have had a stroke or heart attacks or high blood pressure in their family history.
Knowing this gene, that APOE, isn't just informative. You know, there is something that you can modify if you know that you've got bad APOE status. And it has to do with diet. It's dietary. And we see this with our Alzheimer's patients and people who have the APOE4, that's the one that you don't want. Those individuals tend to do better with intermittent fasting, ketogenic diets, things that are higher fat, which is interesting. We're talking about cholesterol. People think, well, higher fat might, and it might raise your cholesterol, but it's protective when it comes to the brain if you're doing it correctly.
Yes, exactly. And it's, the diet is very, very important. So we'll get to that because that's literally the first thing you always start with high blood pressure is lifestyle and diet. Some of the other tests, though, that are actually very useful, you get the blood tests, and it's a Mourn-Death lipid test, testing the cholesterol, but they're looking at the particle sizes. They're looking at the lipoprotein. So some examples are LPA, lipoprotein B. What else is...
They'll look at HDL particle number, LDL particle number, small, dense LDLs.
Yeah.
Because, again, some of these are still relevant because if you do have smaller, denser LDL, and again, LDL is the one that's considered bad. It's not always bad, but those get stuck in the inflammatory crevices, essentially in the blood vessels. So it's just easier to lodge in there. They're innocent bystanders if you think about it. But diet does change how these LDLs are formed in the liver, because really, if your liver is inflamed, then you're going to export a whole bunch of junk in your LDL.
Yeah. And so, speaking of inflammation, one of our other core tests for high blood pressure is omega-3 index. So do you want to speak to that a little bit?
Yeah. Omega-3s, the best ones are fish oil. Now, there are some plant sources of omega-3s. Those aren't converted quite as well in the body to the types of omega-3s that you want. So fish oil really is the best option. And I do know that if you are vegetarian or vegan, I think there are algae-based omega-3s that typically make the cut. But there's two main types of, and there's more than that, but two main types of omega-3. EPA, which is the anti-inflammatory type, and DHA, which is more of a brain structure type. On the test that we look at, we compare the EPA, which is anti-inflammatory, to a type of fat called arachidonic acid, often labeled as AA. That's pro-inflammatory. We look at the ratio between those two. And it's shocking, especially for somebody who's never controlled diet, who comes in looking for help, how bad that ratio can be.
Oh, yes.
Terrible, because the normal ratio should be somewhere between 2-to-1 to 10-to-1.
Yes.
And that's even with the pro-inflammatory one still being a bit higher, which is normal. But we've seen people where it's 150-to-1.
Yes.
Off the charts high. And to fix that, you need both more omega-3, more fish oil.
Yeah.
But then you also have to reduce the inflammatory foods contributing.
Yeah, because that it'll burn up the good anti-inflammatories. And some of the things that people can add into their diet are things like olive oil. Good, clean, pure olive oil. We were just at a seminar a couple weeks back that one of the instructors there was so on top of olive oil that he orders his from Europe. He orders it from Spain, and he orders it from like trees that are 2,000 years old. And yeah, he'll have that and just take a teaspoon of olive oil right out of his bottle because of how good that is for his body, not just the cardiovascular, but it's that good for you too. Mm-hmm. All right, so one of the other tests that we do is a bioimpedance analysis, and this one is interesting. For when it comes from a cardiovascular perspective, the BIA actually gives you a lot of information about what's going on within the body, but it can give us a good idea of the extracellular mass, which is part of our lymphatic network. And if our blood flow is pushing up against this pressure that's our lymph system and our liver system, we will see a higher blood pressure from that. So the BIA becomes very important to see. Are you carrying muscle mass? Are you carrying fat mass? What is your heart pumping against?
Yeah.
And so I like that test a lot.
Yeah, another way to see this is varicose veins in the legs in particular. If you have varicose veins, you know that you've got a pressure problem, usually from lymph.
Yes.
Or it can be damage to the veins as well. But if you have that, you have swelling in the legs, fluid retention, that's a lymphatic backup problem.
Yeah.
That's going to put stress on this whole system. The other thing, too, I did want to mention, it's very common for especially men coming in with this problem to see a huge level of this extracellular mass, this excess buildup. And they don't necessarily have the varicose veins, fluid retention in the legs. Theirs is like a global inflammatory fluid retention problem. A lot of guys, when they start doing a detox or something like that, they'll lose 10 pounds of fluid within a week.
Yeah.
So the inflammation is really the driver, especially as men go.
Yes, and good markers on the lab for inflammation other than the omega-3 index are C-reactive protein, SED rate or ESR is a good one, even fibrinogen, and lately, even though it's got a short half-life, D-dimer is also good. You want to make sure that your blood is not too thick. Ferritin or the iron stores is another good example of something that can be a sign of inflammation within the blood.
Yeah.
And then one other thing that is kind of that sneaks in there is I always have to look at my patient's medications and look for the side effect, because any medication that affects the kidney or liver in excess has the potential of increasing blood pressure.
Yeah.
So always, if you're on medication, look to see if high blood pressure is one of the side effects of the medication, and then address that with your doctor right away if you feel like that might be the main contributor.
Yeah, it's a two-way street, especially with the kidneys.
Yes.
Because if the kidneys aren't working, your body will get signaled to increase blood pressure.
Yes.
And then if it's high blood pressure, it's going to damage the kidneys. So you get into this tailspin a bit.
Yes, exactly. All right, so what do you do when you have blood pressure that's high? So
come to Synapse.
Come to Synapse. beyond that, how do you start?
This lifestyle,
yes.
Diet. We've had people where changing diet alone is the big thing. I have a patient right now. I saw him yesterday. He came in with type 2 diabetes, blood pressure issues, and he's been on essentially a Mediterranean diet for the last month. His blood sugar, I know we're not talking about blood sugar, but it's a good proxy for inflammation. He was running almost 200 fasting in the morning, and now it's been hardly even a month and he's below 100. He's normal. It's 90, just from diet change alone.
Yeah.
So if you can figure out what the things are in your diet that you're either eating too much of or not eating enough of, it seems simple. Diet change is hard, but that sometimes is the only thing you need.
So just some real-life examples. Sugar is very inflammatory for a lot of people and can cause that problem. The top two by far, though, are alcohol and tobacco.
So, oh, yeah.
Smoking.
Don't smoke, don't drink, Dexon.
Yes.
Sure. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it seems easy, but it's not for some people.
So, and if you think about it, so stress, what do people crave when they have stress? Yeah. Salt and sugar.
Yeah, that stuff. And to smoke.
And smoke. So, yeah. So reducing the stress, that's why diet and lifestyle is so, so crucial. So we want to get the good Mediterranean diet, the good, fruits and vegetables, the oils, especially, you know, the olive oils, the good lean, or clean, I should say, foods. And a lot of times the carbs are, something that is, blocking up the liver's ability to pull out that lymph. So we have a lot of people with non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. The rates are actually staggering what's happening with that right now.
Yeah.
So that's the first place to start. Decrease any inflammatory foods. Fruits and vegetables, especially the veggies, are anti-inflammatory and help quite a bit. And reducing the alcohol and the tobacco is also a big, big component for that.
I want to make one more comment on the diet stuff. I've seen some people attempting, you know, to have a healthy diet. They'll go gluten-free, but they'll still eat a lot of processed gluten-free grains.
Yes.
That's still not great. I mean, the process, anything that's processed that's carbohydrate, even if it's labeled as kind of a health food, still has the potential of causing these issues.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's by far the first place that we start. And then you kind of look at what testing has been done. Mm-hmm. So if you are physically inactive, we have to increase your physical activity to get your muscles contracting, to push the lymph flow. But you got to do slow and steady with this because you don't necessarily have the mechanics as far as the cardiovascular system working for you. So it's kind of like opening up a highway that's been taken out by a tornado. There's cement everywhere, and you've got to kind of just ease into it and slowly rebuild that highway internally. So it's not a, I'm going to go back and do the exercise I was doing when I was 20.
Yeah.
You've got to just be consistent with it.
This is why the New Year's resolution.
Yes.
Workout people, where they're going for a month and they'll just hit it really hard, but because they haven't eased into it and their body's not used to it, they crash and burn.
Yeah. Historically, between Halloween and Christmas is when the majority of Americans gain 80% of their weight for the year. And then they try and lose it in January by going hard. And they end up hurting themselves usually. Yeah, and so that's why the New Year's resolutions just don't work. What you want to do is just get into a routine that you can do year round and stick with it through the seasons and make good choices in October, November, and December when it comes to the food.
Yep.
So exercise is a big part of it. Stress management. One of the other tests that we get, can order is an adrenal stress test where we actually look at the HPA axis. And we've talked about this in past podcasts, but the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, we want to see how you're sleeping and the melatonin that's produced. We want to make sure that you're in rest and digest and that you're not spiking with your adrenal hormones. Because think about it, if your adrenaline is high or cortisol is high, that's a stress hormone. If your adrenaline's high, your body is expecting you to what? Go and run or fight. So it's going to increase your blood pressure. That's what adrenaline is meant to do. It increases your heart rate, which will then increase your blood pressure. And if you don't go fight, then you're sitting there and your blood pressure just goes up.
Yeah.
So that's the fight or flight mechanism. And I want to put another caveat here for lifestyle. Caffeine should not be consumed with people with high blood pressure. And because it can also trigger the adrenal response. It can actually affect the liver. And so caffeine has to be regulated properly with the actual blood sugar or blood pressure elevations.
Yeah.
One of the best things for blood pressure is sleep.
Yeah.
Just getting good, deep, restorative sleep.
It's so much so that in some of our patients, especially with unresponsive high blood pressure, will do a sleep test.
Yeah.
We've got an apnea diagnostic test here called a WatchPat test. And that test is an at-home test. You wear just a watch with a finger probe and something on your chest, one little sticker thing. And that's enough to diagnose apnea. If you have apnea, that is a significant factor in high blood pressure.
Yes.
And you won't fix the high blood pressure if you're not fixing the apnea.
Correct.
And fixing the apnea sometimes is a weight thing.
Yep.
Sometimes it's a muscle tone issue. Sometimes there's other structural reasons. Sometimes it's more brain-based. But figuring out if you have sleep apnea and how to fix that has to be addressed.
And I like the WatchPAT, which is an at-home test, better than some of the sleep studies, because you catch things and it's your own home environment.
Yeah.
Versus a lot of people will actually go in and the sleep studies are great as far as, you know, observing and different things that they're looking at, but it's not your own bed. It's not, and you're hooked up to so many more wires. Yeah. This is something where you get a good look in your home environment. So that's why I do actually like the at-home test. Other than improving your sleep, there are some relaxation things. Deep breathing, meditation are very, very helpful with this as well. Just things that that help relax. Prayer can go both ways. If you're praying and you actually feel more relaxed after praying, it helps. If you're praying and it actually works you up because you're praying for someone you're worrying about, it can actually make it worse.
Yeah.
So know yourself. I had to literally change one of my patients' prayer schedule because they were praying for traffic victims, because that's the world she worked in, for the kids right before going to bed. And then she'd have nightmares all night. And so by praying for those kids in the morning, it actually helped her sleep, which then helped us be able to improve her cardiovascular and her anxiety, actually.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Cool. So let's go through briefly. We'll wrap it up here with just some of the we'll name some of the particle sizes and some of the things we look at. But just so you know, there's so many variables. We could have dyslipidemia where the cholesterol is just out of balance. And that just needs some specific attention. We could have high LDLs. High LDLs are the bad cholesterol. And a lot of times you need antioxidants to help with the LDLs. And in particular, with a lot of these, we see niacin is a very important component of cardiovascular function. And berberine has a dual effect, especially with high LDLs, because it helps balance insulin. It's an insulin regulator. It also helps to kill fungal infections, which can actually make blood pressure issues worse. Mm-hmm. So I love berberine as a product, and we use that a lot with the high LDLs. Mm-hmm. High triglycerides, I'm just going to say the first thing I always think of with people who come in high triglycerides is they're just eating too many carbs. That'll just drive your triglycerides high. We also see high, small, dense LDL P particles, and there's a cocktail of different things you can do with antioxidants and anti-inflammatories. High LPA, which a lot of times they say is genetic and is becoming a marker. They're actually arguing about this being a better marker for cardiovascular disease and dysfunction than any other markers. But there's a lot that can go into this one. And N-acetylcysteine, or NAC, is an important part of that one, as well as looking at, again, potential fungal infections and things that can drive that. Also, natokinase and things that thin the blood in a good way are very, very helpful for that. Low HDL. This is one of my hot topics, because this can be so difficult for people to improve upon. And there's some general recommendations. If your good cholesterol, the HDL, is low and you're trying to increase it, they always tell you, first and foremost, lose some weight, reduce your body fat, increase your omega fatty acids, decrease alcohol, increase your resistance training for muscle work. And a lot of times you have to also, a lot of these people are deficient in bile acids. So they're not absorbing the fat soluble vitamins. And so by improving your bile acids, which you can do with improving your gut biome, it's amazing how much the digestive bacteria can influence your blood pressure. And so a lot of that, again, is by diet, and but by just increasing the bile acids, you can actually increase your HDLs as well. Mm-hmm. Yep. And then let's see, as far as anything else, as far as the blood pressure and lab markers, MPO and some other lab markers are good indicators of cardio function. There's a product that we use called CardioFlow that's got the methylated folate in there, as well as magnesium, and L-arginine, which is one of the big markers. And then taurine is in there as well, which helps with the bile part of this whole scenario. So to get your blood flowing, they're working on your liver bile system.
Let's touch on arginine quick, because we should talk about nitric oxide.
So yes.
Nitric oxide, and I think we've talked about this on another podcast, but it's a very small molecule that's made in the blood vessels. Its job is to dilate the blood vessels, which means to make them bigger, right? So if you have high blood pressure and if you don't have nitric oxide working, that could also be the main problem. This also, especially in men, connects with erectile dysfunction. But low nitric oxide can be due to low arginine, which is a protein. There's other nutrients as well that are needed in order to make nitric oxide. And there's even infections that can inhibit your nitric oxide.
Yeah.
Taking CardioFlow with arginine in it is a good option. Some people can't tolerate the arginine. If they have cold sores, it'll make their cold sores worse. In those situations, the replacement there would be citrulline. And that can work just as well for some people. But assessing, this is another reason why we assess with the endopath. The endopath. If you've got poor function of the lining of your blood vessels, supporting nitric oxide can help.
And you touched on something there. People or men with ED, erectile dysfunction, 90% of it improve when you address the same protocol for cardiovascular.
Yeah.
And so because we're addressing stress as well, everyone thinks it's a hormone thing. And they go right to low testosterone or a problem with hormones. And it really is a cardiovascular problem. And so to treat and get to the root cause of erectile dysfunction, you treat high blood pressure or cardiovascular dysfunction. Mm-hmm. And that improves the ED. If you take a pill for ED and it helps with nitric oxide, which helps with the ED, you're not fixing the cardiovascular at all.
No.
And so you're basically just setting yourself up for a heart attack or some type of cardiovascular event down the road.
Yeah, those medications are nothing but glorified blood pressure medications.
Yes, anyways. Yeah, yeah. So let's get to the root cause and see if we can do anything about it.
Yeah. For a lot of the things we talked about, switching gears here quickly, with the cholesterol, if you're going to go to a standard medical doctor, they're likely going to try to put you on a statin.
Yeah.
And if you are on a statin, I would at least encourage you to take CoQ10. CoQ10 is necessary for your cells to make energy,
yes.
For your heart to make energy, for your muscles, your brain to make energy. It's part of your mitochondria, the part that makes the majority of your energy. A statin is going to shut down your ability to make that.
Yes.
We've had people on statins where it's so bad they'll come in a wheelchair wondering, yes. how did my muscles get so bad? And I've got a patient like this I'm working with out of state. And all it is, if you can get off a statin, control everything naturally, the muscles improve, the energy production improves. So statins can be kind of a sneaky thing because medical doctors will hand it out like candy. Yeah. It's even been mentioned, should we put it in the drinking water?
Yes.
Which I hope they never do that.
Yeah, no, they shouldn't.
Yeah.
And it's because they really don't think it's causing this big problem with CoQ10 because it's 10% of the, statistically, it's between 10 and 20% usually when they measure it. But there are other consequences. The CoQ10 depletion is just one of them. Mm-hmm. And again, you're not getting to the root cause of what set up the problem in the first place. And many times people will come and say, well, I've got the genetics. I have to have a statin. And my answer is there are other ways.
Yeah.
And so if you're willing to put the work in, you don't have to be on the statin and you don't have to live with the negative consequences of the statin either.
Yeah, and again, it's really ignoring the inflammatory part.
Yeah.
Because if you can control the inflammation, even if your cholesterol is higher, that's protective.
All right, so now let's finish up here with some Facebook rapid fire. So thank you for sending in the questions. I feel like we need to do some type of, like, I don't know, drum roll or something or something that's like, oh, there's Marquis' input. Thank you.
Funny drum roll.
Yes.
From the drummer, too.
No? From the drummer. Yeah, he actually plays the drums. Yeah.
He didn't know what it was.
All right,
what
so first question. Should folate be taken with low B12 and high homocysteine? It's a great question.
That's a good question. I love the methylation cycle. I'll try not to get too nerdy on my answer.
So he really does.
I do.
Yes.
Part of it is because I have the genetics that make mine break
yes.
really easily. High homocysteine, let's start there. Homocysteine is the byproduct of your methylation cycle. methylation is really just it's a way of your body modifying different substances. It modifies DNA. It can modify certain chemicals to improve detoxification and clearance. That whole system also helps you produce glutathione, which is your main antioxidant, helps you make taurine, which we just mentioned is helpful for the liver. That whole system does a lot. It's very important, and it's a high demand system in the body. If your homocysteine is high, it means that you have an inefficiency somewhere in that system.
Yes.
Homocysteine alone is also inflammatory. If it's above, even if it's above 8, certainly above 10, you are increasing your risk for cardiovascular disease, like we just talked about, stroke risk, and cognitive decline.
Yes.
None of those are great. So I tend to be very picky on homocysteine. If it's above 10 in particular, even though medically that's okay, according to the research, that's a long-term inflammatory risk.
Yes. Yeah. And it is significant.
Mm-hmm. Significant. So the question is, if you've got that high, you've got low B12, should you also take folate? And so this gets into, again, the pathway of how do you get your homocysteine down?
Yes.
The B vitamins play a huge role no matter which direction you try to push it. There's multiple directions, and I won't get into those details. Some people have heard of an enzyme called MTHFR. That is the way that your body activates folate to use it correctly in this cycle.
Yes.
And so that's broken in a high number of individuals. That's when I mentioned that I have a problem here. That's what I've got. I've got an issue that makes my enzyme there only work at about 20 to 40% capacity. Now, the way that you get around that, you've really got a couple of options. You can take methylated folate, which bypasses that.
Yep.
You can supplement with B12. You can also supplement with B2, riboflavin. I won't get into exactly why. I think that gets too detailed for this question. But
yeah, and this person did actually mention that they have low B12, but when they take B12, they get jittery. And this is very common. Yes, so this part is very important to listen to answer your question specific.
And part of it depends on the type of B12.
It does.
And so some people can handle and should use a methylated B12. For some people, that form is too potent.
Yes.
And it has to be balanced with folate even.
Yes.
And so the balance of this is not always so simple as saying, I'm just going to take a boatload of methylated B vitamins, methylfolate, methyl B12, and get past this problem. Some people can tolerate that. But for people who can't, either different forms of B12 or supporting, especially if their B12 is lab low. I mean, if your B12 is lab low, you know you need it. It's just that you got to find a different form that works and a dose that works. Adding in folate, though, can increase your tolerance.
Yes.
Adding in glycine can increase your tolerance. And again, this is getting probably more complicated than
I want to go through this process a little bit.
It is
because,
important.
Because the way I tell people to navigate this is you have to go low and start slow, and you have to observe, because there's so many forks in the road when it comes to this process. So the answer to your question is, should folate be taken with low B12 and high homocysteine? The answer is yes. Maybe.
Probably.
And probably.
Yeah.
And then the answer is the right form of folate, just to make sure it works. And then you have to just course correct along the way.
What order?
So what order? So you have to do things in different orders. So you may have to pull homocysteine down a different pathway, which requires B6 and iron.
Yeah.
So if you're low iron, then you have to work on that first. B6 a lot of times is thrown off because of stuff in our gut.
Yeah.
So if you're getting jittery from B12, then that is a sign that there's some other level of dysfunction. Usually we see that with some problem with the GI tract.
Yeah.
So the right form of B12, like Dr. Josh said, methylcobalamin, as well as fixing the GI dysfunction. And some people need SAMe, and some people have to avoid it like the plague. And so it's one of those things where there's some mechanisms here that have to be identified. Now, I have found tremendous success with people who are jittery from the B6. They have to get their magnesium and B6 right. They have to get sleeping restored. They have to be able to sleep better.
Yeah.
And so you focus on the things that help with the sleep. Magnesium is one of the important minerals, and it's the number one deficiency in the United States. So magnesium is a very common one. And things like the B6, the iron, the glycine, serine, even with some people.
Mm-hmm.
What else is, I know I'm missing one. Oh, B3 can sometimes be needed.
Yeah, especially with the recycling of glutathione.
Yes.
And I mentioned B2, riboflavin, that helps with the enzyme for the folate conversion. What I think of here, one of the other reasons potentially for the jitteriness is a detox reaction.
Yes.
Too, because if you're not able to, if all of a sudden you take these things and you're making, you know, glutathione better, you're making, you're methylating better, all these different substances, you might start to push stuff out that makes you feel weird.
Yes.
Makes you feel lousy.
Yeah. So if you have flu-like symptoms, then that can actually be a good thing because you've just improved your levels of glutathione and you're detoxifying better. So that's why it's such a tricky thing. Everyone just wants, you know, they hear about MTHFR and they say, oh, take this and we're done. It doesn't work that way. In fact, again, at this seminar I was at a couple weeks ago, this geneticist didn't say I hate MTHFR, but basically said she does not like how people think everything's just linear.
Yeah.
You never treat a single SNP by itself. And it's very true. So there are so many forks in the road. So that's why I love this question. It's a little, it's complex, but the answer again is yes, you should take folate, right type with low B12, have to discern through how to be able to get the correct B12 without the jitteriness. We tend to need to work on our digestive dysfunction, maybe liver dysfunction. And sometimes you have to do other detoxes. If the bowels are constipated, magnesium is usually what's needed to help with that process as well. So love that question. And now we're going to move on to our two more. We've got one that's real quick here, so we'll wrap that one up. Any doctor recommendations for the San Francisco area for functional medicine? And our answer is?
Unfortunately,
no. We don't have anyone. I'm sure they exist there, but we don't have anyone that we've worked with in that area. So thanks for asking that.
Yeah.
Last question to wrap up here. Is there a safe way to get off PPIs and replace it with something that will be safe? Mm-hmm. So the answer is yes, absolutely. And just like with everything else with functional medicine, there are probabilities here. And the PPIs, for those that don't know what a PPI is, a proton pump inhibitor, people are given that for challenges with acid reflux. And my biggest problem with that is the long-term consequences when people are on PPIs. When you are inhibiting your body's acid production, the general outcome is increased body acid. So we did a whole podcast just on that topic. The fast explanation and the safe way to do it is you have to find out why you're not regulating the stomach acid properly. It can be an infection, like H. pylori is out of control. It can be a sleep disorder where your brain is not supporting the digestive function. It can be a histamine or zinc imbalance that's causing a timing mechanism issue as far as when you're releasing the stomach acid. We've even seen functionally the stomach gets caught in the diaphragm and it's a functional hiatal hernia where it's being squeezed and the parietal cells in the stomach release the stomach acid. So the answer is yes, there is a safe way to get off the PPIs. I'm not 100% on that with my patients, but pretty darn close. There was just a couple of people that were in their 80s that was very challenging to get them off their PPIs without the reflux. And one of the things that is very, very undervalued is the role of melatonin, because the actual valve where the reflux comes out of that can start to affect the esophagus and stuff, that valve is like a muscle. And if it's weak, then it doesn't hold the stomach acid in. And that valve, is the number one thing that strengthens that valve, melatonin.
Yeah.
So melatonin gets decreased with age. It also gets decreased with stress, infection, and inflammation. So again, work on the stress, infection, inflammation. It is a larger program. It's a harder work to get off the PPIs, but you're also preventing, and we've done this before, you have to go back to the podcast, but you're preventing things potentially like cancers and infections that like acidic things in the body. So there's a lot of value to getting off the PPIs and fixing the actual mechanisms, making sure your sleep is good. Some people, I know the answer they want to hear is just take apple cider vinegar and everything will be okay. It doesn't work that way, although there might be some benefit to it.
Yeah. Some people it is easier because it's the assumption medically is that if you've got reflux, you've got high stomach acid.
Yes.
And that's frankly really not true in a lot of people. It can be the opposite.
Most people. Yeah.
Most people it's opposite. We as humans, especially if you look at diets of our ancestors, right? It was, there was a lot of meat being consumed. We have higher stomach acid than some other animals that would be considered carnivorous. We're meant to have high stomach acid.
Yeah.
And so if you don't have that stomach acid or those other things aren't working, that can be the cause of reflux. As you mentioned, that muscle at the top of the stomach that responds to melatonin also responds to stomach acid.
Yeah.
You need stomach acid to keep it tight.
Yes.
So if you keep pushing down stomach acid, you increase your likelihood for reflux once you go off the medication. So there's a rebound effect and you kind of have to work through that issue.
Yeah. And anything that causes tension on the stomach, like a spasm in the small intestine, will actually pull on the stomach and release stomach acid. Mm-hmm. So the parietal cells release stomach acid when they have a bolus of food or weight of any kind, and when they get pulled, when they get stretched.
Yep.
All right, great questions. Keep sending them in, and we will address them as we go with our podcast. So that was the Facebook rapid fire and our topic today, high blood pressure. A lot more to it, but we look forward to bringing up more good topics. Keep sending them in. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you for listening to the Synapse Nips podcast. If you like what you heard, subscribe to the podcast and share the podcast. To learn more, check out our website at www.officialsynapse.com. Until next time, this has been Synapse Nips Podcast. We'll see you on the next episode. This podcast is for information purposes only and should under no circumstances be considered medical advice or a substitute for medical care. Any information given in this podcast is not intended to diagnose or treat any disease and is at the user's own risk. Please first consult a licensed healthcare professional.